It's time for Bigler's World for the next hour. And that's going to make me Jim Bigler. Going to be reading all kinds of kids' magazines. I got all kinds of stuff. Some Natural Geographic. Maybe some Time magazine for kids. What else do I have here? Some science news. I think we'll start with Dogo news. Yes, it's Dogo news for the kids. We do it all for the kids. New supergiant isopod species named after Darth Vader. That's the title of this thing. Alvaro Aragon wrote it. Goes like this. With two pairs of antenna, large compound eyes, and four sets of jaws, giant isopods look like creatures from a science fiction movie. Now researchers have discovered a new supergiant isopod species with a head strikingly similar to Darth Vader's helmet. In a nod to the iconic Star Wars villain, they have named it Bathyonymus Verderi, okay, or B. Vader, or B. Vaderi, there it is. Let's see, who is this? Study author Peter Ng, he's a crustacean researcher at the National University in Singapore, says, I am the biggest Star Wars fan in the team, as it's my vintage. The first movie was in 1977 in my youth, and it was cool. But we all agree that the face of B. Vaderi looks so much like Darth Vader that it just had to be named after the Scythe Lord. Scyther Sith, I don't know what it is. The newly found species belongs to the Bathyonymus family, a genus of about 20 giant isopod species. These massive creatures inhabit the deepest parts of the ocean, making them difficult to study. Despite their scary appearance, giant isopods are harmless to humans. They feed on dead animals and decaying matter, playing a crucial role in recycling nutrients. Weighing more than 2.2 pounds and reaching lengths of up to 12.8 inches, B. vaderi is one of the largest known giant isopod species. But it is not the largest. No, no, that title belongs to B. Jamesi, which can reach about 20 inches and weigh over 5 pounds. So far, B. vaderi has only been found near an island in the South China Sea, but it may also inhabit other areas of the region. While the species is new to science, locals in Vietnam and China have been enjoying it and other giant isopods as seafood since 2017. Once considered an accidental catch by fishers, they are now a seafood delicacy. In fact, the four B. vaderi specimens examined by scientists came from markets and restaurants in Vietnam. The researchers published their findings in the journal Zookies on January 14th of 2025. They worry that increased demand for giant isopods as seafood could threaten their populations. These creatures lay few eggs and grow slowly. If their population keeps rising, they could vanish. If their popularity keeps rising, they could vanish. Though often called sea bugs, isopods are crustaceans more closely related to lobsters and shrimp. In fact, that's what they look like. They look like the tail. The whole animal looks like the tail of a lobster. There are an estimated 10,000 isopod species, most of which are extremely small. These creatures inhabit a wide range of environments, from mountains and deserts to the deep sea. Despite their diverse habitats, all isopods have segmented bodies, multiple legs, and a rigid exoskeleton. This gives them an alien-like appearance, especially the giant deep-sea isopods. Next article here on Bigler's World, sticking with Dogo News. Scientists find a way to unlock water from moon dust. Of all the places. Alvaro Aragon wrote this article. Goes a little like this. Water is crucial for setting up a human base on the moon. But if researchers at the Chinese Academy of Sciences succeed, this will no longer be a hurdle. They have found a way to produce large amounts of water using the hydrogen in lunar soil. For their study, professional Jung Quang Mueng and his team used lunar soil samples collected during the Chang'e's 5 mission back in 2020. They used concave mirrors to focus sunlight onto the dirt, heating it to over 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit. This intense heat caused a chemical reaction between the hydrogen and the other elements in the soil, releasing water vapor. The vapor was then collected and condensed into liquid water. Even more exciting, heating just 1 gram of lunar soil produced 51 to 76 milligrams of water. Scaled up, 1 ton of moon dirt could produce over 100 pounds of drinkable water. That's 45 kilograms, by the way, if you're, you know, Canadian or something. This is enough to sustain up to 50 astronauts daily. Beyond drinking water, the extracted water could support plant growth in lunar greenhouses. This would ensure a reliable food source for long-term missions. Additionally, astronauts could split water molecules into oxygen and hydrogen. The oxygen could then be used for breathing and the hydrogen as rocket fuel. The researchers who published their findings in the journal Innovation in late 2024 still face some challenges. Since the method depends on solar energy, water extraction would only be possible during the 2-week-long lunar day. It would completely halt during the lunar night, which lasts just as long. Water production would also vary by location due to differences in soil composition. The team hopes to test their method on samples collected from various lunar regions during future missions. If these hurdles can be overcome, the ability to produce water on the moon could be a game changer. It would reduce costs and make long-term lunar exploration more feasible. Okay, let us go to another publication right here on Bigler's World, on Bigler's World. Let's do a little National Geographic Kids magazine. This is under the Women Heroes section, Susan B. Anthony, the woman who helped fight for women's right to vote. Let's see, Johanna Rizzo wrote this article. Susan B. Anthony was called terrible names, had things thrown at her, even had her picture dragged through the streets. Her picture? But still, she didn't back down. She thought fighting for women's rights and the rights of everyone was too important. Born in Adams, Massachusetts, on February 15th, 1820, she grew up as a Quaker, which is a religion that teaches that everyone is equal. She knew that it wasn't fair that she didn't have any say in electing political leaders or couldn't own property just because she was a woman. She also thought that it wasn't right that male teachers made more money than she did. In the early 1850s, Anthony started voicing her opinion to anyone who would listen, stopping people on the streets or giving speeches around the country. She'd stand for hours to get signatures on petitions asking for women's rights. But Anthony wanted everyone to have equal rights, so in 1856, she joined the anti-slavery movement as an abolitionist, which were people who argued against slavery. She gave speeches, organized meetings, and put up posters, and handed out leaflets, even though she faced angry crowds of people who disagreed with her and thought that women shouldn't even be speaking in public. But her fight for equal rights for women never stopped. Anthony had met fellow activist Elizabeth Cady Stanton in 1851, and after years of talking to people about women's rights, they started a newspaper, The Revolution, in 1868, to help spread ideas of rights for women. The next year, they co-founded the National Women's Suffrage Association to focus on women's right to vote. Suffrage means the right to vote, it says here. People who support that are called suffragists. African Americans were recognized as U.S. citizens in 1870, and black men were given the right to vote with the 15th Amendment. But African American women, like all women, still did not have the right to vote. This made Anthony angry, especially since she had fought so hard to help free the slaves. So she cast her ballot in the presidential election anyway. She was arrested for the crime and fined $100. She never paid. Though she worked for more than 50 years on women's rights, Anthony never got to legally vote. She died on March 13th, 1906, 14 years before the 19th Amendment gave all women the right to vote. But the representatives of Congress, almost all men, who approved the amendment, understood who was responsible for this historic moment. And the legislation was known as the Anthony Amendment. And in 1979, Anthony became the first woman to be on a U.S. coin, the silver dollar. Okay, let's go to another publication here. Let's do a little science news explores. Bum, bum. It's an explainer. How our body deals with stress. Our sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems coordinate to help us cope. Or in my case, not cope. Jennifer, I think that's Younghans. Spelled with a J. Younghans. It is the day of a big test. Your heart is pounding. Your palms are sweating. Your breathing quickens and your stomach suddenly feels full of butterflies. Although the stress response may not feel good, they are totally normal. They are your body's way of sharpening your focus and boosting the energy you have to help you perform well. When we encounter a big challenge or risk or become overly excited, our body responds in a way to keep us safe. We are hardwired for this. These changes supercharge how our body functions. An increased heart rate and breathing will send more oxygen to our muscles and brain. Our muscles tense so they can react quickly. By sweating, our body attempts to avoid overheating. Our pupils enlarge so we become more aware of our surroundings, and our body releases stress hormones such as adrenaline and cortisol to boost our energy and focus. Explainer, what is a hormone? I'm not going to go there. I could click on it, but I'm not going to click. Together, these changes are known as the fight or flight response. They are automatically triggered by what's known as the sympathetic nervous system. It helps us respond to danger or challenges. They give us more power, more speed, and agility. All are important for physical activity, says Catherine Metals. She's a neurologist for children in Denver, Colorado. This survival mechanism helped our ancient hunter-gatherer ancestors fight or escape from a wild animal, perhaps a saber-toothed tiger. Today we face very different risks than people did 300,000 years ago, but our sympathetic nervous system remains very important to our making it through challenging events. It turns on when we play sports, perform, or catch ourselves from falling. It motivates us to study or concentrate on difficult tasks. And it turns on when we're trying something new or talking to someone we like. Activating that fight or flight response in short bursts is healthy. But as soon as the stimulating event is over, our brain normally sends signals to our body to calm down. This turns on a second system, the parasympathetic nervous system. It handles what is known as the rest and digest response. Here, our heart rate and breathing becomes slow and steady. Our muscles relax, stress hormone levels lower, and feel-good hormones such as oxytocin and serotonin become somewhat higher. This lets us feel safe. We can now think, there it is, calmly, digest food and sleep, all processes vital to our brain and overall health, notes Metals. You're in a rest and digest state when enjoying downtime with your family and friends, or when you're curled up on your couch relaxing with your cat or dog under a favorite blanket, or when you feel joy and wonder out in nature. The sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems keep our body in balance. Together, they make up the autonomic nervous system. By switching between rest and action, they work together to help us respond appropriately to the range of situations we experience. How to calm an overstressed body and mind. But sometimes these systems get out of balance. The sympathetic nervous system may stay active for too long, or it may get stuck in the on position when it's not needed. Our world is full of threats. For example, the erratic impacts of climate change not only are hard to predict, but can also pose true threats. Social media can pressure us to live or act a certain way, and parents can pressure us to perform well in a competitive environment. Encountering such conditions may keep your body stuck in fight or flight mode. Worrying about things is not failing or shortcoming, says Metals. It's natural and reflects the way that our brains are wired. But too much anxiety can leave you overwhelmed and unable to perform. See, is this, no, this is somebody else. Jin Lee, a psychologist for children in Inglewood, Colorado, says, how you think and how you feel will show up in your body because the brain and the body are connected. When you're stressed or anxious, your body might feel as if it's not getting enough air. You might bite your nails or freeze up so that you have a hard time thinking or making decisions. Your mind may even go blank. Explains Lee, this is the body's way of communicating to our brain, hey, something is not right. At these times, your body's responses may not serve your best interests. Fortunately, it's possible to modify them through practice, says Metals. In as little as 5 minutes a day, you can learn to switch from an overactive fight or flight mode to a calm body and mind. Preteens and teenagers are in a great position to start learning these skills, she says, because the adolescent brain is so adaptable. Here are a few simple techniques. Okay, it says here, validate what you're feeling. Remind yourself that your body responds this way for a reason. You can even talk to yourself, Lee suggests. For example, my muscles are tight. I'm breathing really fast. The reason I do that is because I care about this project and I want to do a good job. There's nothing wrong with me when I do this. My body is reacting, but it is safe and so am I. So am I. See, the second one they got here. Reframe your thinking. You can reshape how you view a situation, says Metals. Decide if your feelings match what's happening. Maybe it's okay to calm down a little. Then there's focus on breathing. Deep breathing can make you lightheaded, so Lee says to breathe normally but slowly. Pay more attention to breathing out, which turns on our rest and digest mode. Activities that naturally focus on exhaling and calming down include blowing bubbles, humming, and singing, all at the same time. Do something fun. Go outside and enjoy yourself, says Lee. Play is especially helpful for someone who is so stressed that they feel frozen or stuck. Play naturally makes us feel better. It also yanks us out of a dormant state, she notes. Use your five senses. Our senses can help us feel grounded. They refocus our attention and let our brain know we're okay. For example, watch clouds change shapes in the sky. Listen to birds sing, pet your dog, smell flowers, or a comforting scent. Taste something pleasant. Getting out in nature, even your own yard, can engage all of your senses and calm your mind and body. Relax your muscles is the last one they have here. Tense your muscles for 5 seconds. Now let them relax. Repeat. Rinse. Doesn't say rinse. This helps calm your body, says Lee. It also makes you aware of how your body is doing instead of just relying on how you think your body is doing. The next time you feel overstressed, remember you have the power to calm your body and mind. With a little practice, a few simple tactics can help you calm down. Next article here on Bigler's World, sticking with Science News Explorers. I like this one. It's weird. They got a video here of a guy with a kind of a glove thing that's moving his fingers around. It's a rather large glove. A robotic hand helps piano players' fingers move faster. Well, I guess so. Similar devices might someday help train pro gamers, athletes, or surgeons, says Catherine Hulick, who wrote this. You're practicing a new song on piano. One part keeps tripping you up. No matter how many times you try it, your fingers just won't move fast enough. Then you put on a special device that looks like a robotic hand. Its motor wiggles your fingers faster than you could move them on your own. When you sit at the piano again, without the robo hand, your fingers can now hop into high gear. You're playing the fast part that seemed impossible before. In recent series of experiments, dozens of professional piano players had this exact experience. They improved their piano skills using a wearable robotic hand, also called an exoskeleton. Sanichi Furua, there it is, and his team shared their results January 15th in Science Robotics. Says Furua, many people are using this kind of robot for rehabilitation or virtual reality gaming. I thought maybe this is also good for music education. Furua is a researcher at the Neuro Piano Institute at Sony Computer Science Laboratories, Inc., in Tokyo, Japan. Here's another name, Nicholas Hatzopoulos. He studies sensory motor control at the University of Chicago in Illinois. A neuroscientist, he did not take part in the new study, but he really liked it and said, I thought it was super cool. Okay, is that all we're going to get from him? A new way to practice. Furuya used to be a professional musician. I practiced piano like 10 hours every day, he says. He practiced so much that he developed a movement disorder in his hands. It's why, he says, I changed my career from pianist to scientist. His hands are doing better now, and he still plays and teaches piano. But a few years ago, he also started imagining a new way for musicians to practice. I was thinking maybe we need some kind of robot that can teach how to move the fingers, he says. Furuya is not an engineer, so he told one of his colleagues about the idea. He wondered if it might be possible to build such a robot, and he was told, yeah, why not? The robot they built fits over one hand. To test the device, Furuya and his colleagues brought professional pianists, into the lab. The number of subjects was very impressive, says Hatzopoulos. For one experiment, 60 pianists practice the same complex pattern. It involves pressing down the index and ring finger together, then the middle finger and pinky together. You switch back and forth as fast as possible. Try it, it commands us. Maybe later. Even moving very slowly, this is super tricky. The pianists practiced until their fingers couldn't move any faster. The researchers then divided the 60 pianists into 5 groups. The first group wore the robot hand as they played the tricky pattern. It moved the fingers faster than the musicians could manage on their own. For the second group, the device moved the fingers slowly in the same tricky pattern. The third group experienced rapid finger motion, but all of the fingers moved at once. 2 other groups didn't use the robo hand. One of these continued to practice the tricky pattern on their own, and the final group just rested. I guess they're the control group. I don't know. Afterward, only one group could play the tricky pattern faster than before. These were the pianists who used the robotic hand to practice the complex finger motions quickly. The time between their keystrokes sped up by around 6% on average. The pianists often told Furuya that their fingers felt very light after using the robot. They also only used the device on their right hands, yet their left hand's speed also improved, says Hatzopoulos. I was stunned by that, actually. One day after the training with the robot, these pianists could still play faster than usual. Furuya doesn't expect the effect to last much longer than that, though. He thinks pianists would probably have to use the device regularly to maintain the speed bonus. Alas, they can't do this now, and he says Furuya, this is still a prototype, so they can't yet take the device home with them. Hatzopoulos thinks this robot training likely rewired some neural connections in the musicians' brains. The somatosensory cortex is the brain region responsible for handling sensory feedback. It's what gets it activated as the robot wiggles people's fingers. When someone wiggles their own fingers, a different part of the brain, the motor cortex, manages that motion. But these two parts of the brain share information. So do the left and right sides of the brain, which control the opposite sides of the body. These connections could help explain why training improved the musicians' speed in their left hands, even though they only wore the device on their right. Therapy, sports, gaming, and beyond. Doctors and researchers already use robotic devices similar to this one in therapy, notes Hatzopoulos. For example, a stroke often impairs movement on one side of the body. Using a robot to move an arm that can help a patient get back their former range of motion. Exoskeletons that move fingers on hands have lagged behind, though. That's because robotic fingers are complex and harder to build, says Hatzopoulos. The robot hand Furuya's team built can only move fingers one way in a downward motion. "We are developing a more complex robot," he says. "It will be able to move two joints at once. This will allow for even more complex finger movements." Furuya imagines that robot training could help people master many activities beyond piano keys. Pro gamers must practice complex keyboard or joystick motions. Surgeons have to learn complicated, delicate hand movements. And baseball pitchers need to master gripping the ball in a certain way. If a robot can help someone train these sorts of hand motions, Furuya says, maybe practice won't have to feel so repetitive. They can use practice time for more creative activities, he says. Okay, let's go to another publication here on Bigler's World. Let's do a little Ranger Rick magazine, s'il vous plaît. The name of this article is Betty's Bay Baboons. Not sure what that means. Anne Cecil wrote this. In a little seaside town in South Africa, some lively baboons have made themselves at home. When you look out your window, you might be able to spot a bird, a squirrel, or even a deer. Imagine if you saw a couple of baboons staring back at you. For wildlife photographer Peter Oxford, that's not unusual at all. Pete and his wife, Renee, they live in Betty's Bay, a small coastal village in South Africa. The town is nestled between a mountain range and the ocean. Every day, a troop of baboons climbs down from the mountains and heads into town. Pete and Renee spend a lot of time observing their movements and capturing their antics on camera. It's not hard to spot them. Baboons are one of the largest kinds of monkeys. Weighing up to 100 pounds, a male baboon could be heavier than you are. The baboons in Betty's Bay are, Kakma baboons, one of six species of baboons that all live in Africa. Every baboon has a different personality and a special job to do. Some of the adult baboons take care of the younger ones. Others chase away outsider baboons. They got outsiders. And some are peacemakers trying to break up any fights within the troop. So it says here, let's see what else these town monkeys are up to. I will. I'm going to see right here. A day in Betty's Bay. As with all baboons, the ones in Betty's Bay rank themselves according to their levels of importance in the troop. For example, the big boss is Che, a male baboon that became head of the troop when he was quite young. He learned quickly. Pete says he now acts like an army general. He organizes the other males in the troop to protect their feeding areas from outsider baboons. The lead female is called Sista. She does the day-to-day running of the troop. She must discipline any baboons that step out of line. That's in quotation marks. She also often decides where the troop will go to eat, and eating is one of the baboons' favorite things to do. Baboons will eat almost anything. In the wild, they tend to dine on fruits, seeds, grass, flowers, and other plant parts. But human food is one of the reasons they like going to town so much. If a kitchen window is left open, baboons won't hesitate to climb right in. And trash cans that have not been secured can lead to a baboon buffet. But human food isn't healthy for baboons, and most folks don't want a monkey hanging out in their homes or making a mess of their trash. Some people in Betty's Bay see the baboons as pests. Pete and his friends have been working with other townspeople to make sure windows are screened and trash cans are covered. That way people and monkeys can live in peace together, all calling Betty's Bay their home. Living together with them monkeys. Next article here, sticking with Ranger Rick. Wildlife. Who wrote this? Luis Wolflin. It starts like this. A love for wildlife led Dr. Ray to live a... Okay, Ray Wynn Grant knew at a young age that she wanted to work with wild animals. She loved watching nature programs on TV so much that she'd tell people that she would be a nature show host herself one day. When Ray got to college, she discovered a whole field of science, wildlife ecology, behind all those programs. So that's what she chose to study. And now Dr. Ray does it all. She's a wildlife ecologist who studies bears and other large carnivores or meat eaters, and she co-hosts a nature TV program. During filming, Dr. Ray interviews a guest perched on her arm. It's a weirdly wonderful bird called a tawny frogmouth. Yes, I said tawny frogmouth, and I meant it. Where the bears are. Dr. Ray began her career studying black bears. Part of her work was to put radio collars on captured adult bears. That helped her keep track of where each collared bear would be throughout the year. During winters, Dr. Ray and her fellow researchers would visit each female's den about 6 weeks after cubs were born. They'd sedate the mother bear, which kept her fast asleep, while they pulled out the cubs. They'd quickly count the cubs, check whether each was male or female, weigh them, attach ID ear tags, then tuck them back in the den with their warm, sleepy mom. Tiny cubs can't keep warm on their own, but a research team member can tuck one inside a warm jacket to keep it toasty while waiting its turn for a checkup. Dr. Ray demonstrates her cub warming technique while being filmed for a TV show. Beyond bears. Dr. Ray has studied many animals besides black bears, including brown bears, lions, lemurs, and jaguars. She says that tracking, capturing, measuring, and releasing wild animals can be a bit nerve-wracking. But she's never been scared while doing her work. No, no, no. She's always careful to make sure that she and her team are never in any danger. What does scare her? Thunderstorms, it says here. Lights, camera, action. Dr. Ray was excited to be asked to co-host the TV program Wild Kingdom, Protecting the Wild. She could inspire a whole new audience, sharing the excitement and wonder she'd felt as a child watching nature shows. And it would let people see a young black woman, who leads wildlife ecology studies and hosts a wildlife TV program. Dr. Ray wants people to know that everyone of any identity naturally belongs in nature's spaces. Dr. Ray also likes all the learning she gets to do for Wild Kingdom. Each episode focuses on a different animal and some of the people working to protect it. Dr. Ray loves being able to interact with so many animal experts. She's also had some amazing experiences while filming. For example, she once joined some shark experts for a swim in the ocean with three different kinds of sharks. She says it was thrilling. Filming a TV program is hard work. The team decides what animals to feature, and they figure out where to go. Once they get there, they do a lot of filming in a short amount of time. This may set up a trial camera. Is that a trail camera? It's a trail camera. They picture one here, like the one Dr. Ray is attaching to this tree trunk at the left here. The camera will record any animal that moves past its lens. Each filming adventure almost always means starting work early in the morning and finishing late at night. What's next? Dr. Ray plans to keep doing research and co-hosting Wild Kingdom. She doesn't know exactly where this will take her, but she does know that it will be wild. Dr. Ray gave this, in this picture here, she gave this sedated bear a quick checkup and a new radio collar, brand new. The new model is just great. She removed the eye protection before the bear woke up. So they got, the bear looks like it's sleeping. Actually, it is. Filming takes place, Dr. Ray and her co-host, Peter Gross, just about everywhere, from deserts to forests, from mountains to seashores, white with foam. Next, stop for this trapped beaver. They got a picture of this. They trapped this beaver. A wild place, as they're going to turn it loose. A wild place where it can build dams without causing trouble for people. You don't want to go causing trouble for people. Okay, do I have one or two more articles here from Ranger Rick? I think this is just one. It's called Orcas. It's got an exclamation point at the end of it, so you have to say, orcas! Sorry. This article, also in Ranger Rick, by Kathy Cranking. What's black and white and wet all over? An orca, of course. This commands me to check out this group of orcas, a bunch of them in the water. These powerful members of the dolphin family are amazing for their size and strength. If you want to know how big an orca is, picture a black and white school bus with fins cruising past you. The largest male orcas can be almost that long. And orcas aren't just big. They're, by Kathy Cranking, strong swimmers, okay? They can reach a speed of about 35 miles per hour in short bursts. Orcas, also known as killer whales, live in all of the world's oceans. They belong to a different group called ectotypes. Ecotypes. They have their own habitat, behaviors, diet, and six other characteristics. But they're not going to get into it, I guess. But all kinds of orcas have everything they need to be fierce predators: speed, strength, intelligence, and sharp teeth. Orcas often hunt in packs, just as wolves do. That's why they're sometimes called the wolves of the sea. What big eyes! From a distance, an orca looks as if it had two big white eyes. But those white areas aren't the orca's eyes at all. They are patches of white skin near the orca's actual eyes. Scientists have different ideas about the purpose of an orca's eye patches. One idea is that the patches may help the orcas see each other when they are hunting together in murky water. An orca's small dark eyes are below those white patches. Orcas have great eyesight both below and above the surface of the water. What big ears! You might think big ears would be all the better to hear with, but these wolves don't need large ears to hear well. Orcas' ears are inside their heads, with just tiny openings behind their eyes. And even though orcas' ears are small, their sense of hearing is huge. They can hear sounds from up to 30 miles away. Sounds travel through a fat-filled part of an orca's jaw to its ears. Orcas rely on their sense of hearing for communication, hunting, and finding their way around. They also have a special sense called echolocation. And here's how it works. An orca makes some clicking sounds from inside its head. These sounds travel through the water. If the sounds hit something in front of the orca, they bounce back as echoes. By listening to the echoes, the orca can tell the size and shape of the object, how far away it is, and if it's moving, which way it's going. It's as if the orca were seeing with sound. What big teeth! An orca's teeth can be as long as your pinky. The sharp teeth are great for grasping, ripping, and tearing, but an orca doesn't use its teeth for chewing. It swallows its meals whole. Different ecotypes of orcas eat different foods, including seals, fish, penguins, sea turtles, whales, and even other dolphins. Oh, no. Orcas are fierce predators, and some ecotypes will work together to hunt prey. For example, a group that may herd a school of fish into a tight circle and use their strong tails to stun the fish. That way the meal is easier to gobble up. What big babies! Orcas live in family groups called pods. A pod can have as few as 5 members or as many as 40. Pods are usually made up of related mother orcas and their male and female young of different ages. A mother orca usually has one baby or calf at a time. A newborn calf is twice as long as you are tall, and it can be more than 3 times as heavy as you. The skin of a newborn orca is black with cream-colored pale yellow or even orange patches. As the baby grows older, the patches change to white. The mother orca will nurse her calf for up to 2 years. What a big mystery! In recent years, some pods of orcas have been doing something that puzzled scientists. These orcas, which live in the waters near Spain, have been ramming into boats. They've even caused enough damage to some boats to make them sink. At first, scientists didn't understand why the orcas would do this, but now some believe that the animals may be practice hunting, ramming into boats the way they ram into large fish prey. Others think the orcas might simply be playing. Maybe to those orcas, a boat is just a big toy. So now you know orcas, the big bad wolves of the sea. An orca breathes air with lungs, just as you do. It comes to the surface to breathe through a blowhole on the top of its head. An orca has 40 or more sharp teeth. They're cone-shaped. And it says here, watch it. When an orca wants to see what's happening above water, the water surface there, it spy hops. It pokes its head out of the water to look around. And they got a picture of the orcas below here, working together to hunt. Let's see, is that the end of the article? Almost. Their bodies make a big wave that would knock this unlucky seal sitting on this chunk of ice into the water. A baby orca drinks milk from its mother, and they have this picture of that happening. The orca calf usually swims close to its mother. The people on this boat they picture here are getting a good view of some passing orcas. Orcas sometimes leap out of the water, a behavior called breaching. Scientists think there may be different reasons why they do this, but only orcas know for sure. Okay, let us move to another publication. Let's do a little Time for Kids. That's right, it's Time Magazine, and it's for the kids. No Action Too Small is the name of this article, written by one of their kids, TFK Kid Reporter. See if I can pronounce this. Safiya Hussein. What is this? It looks like it's a book review. When Geeta moves to the United States with her mom, she leaves her family behind in India, along with everything she has ever known. The change isn't easy. At school, people make fun of her and her accent. To cope, Geeta plays her flute and visits the beach. She meets Miguel, and they help rescue a stranded harp seal pup. Visiting the pup makes Geeta happy, and she and Miguel start a program to clean up the beach. In Safe Harbor, author and former oceanographer Padma Vekatrama encourages readers to find ways to help the environment. And she says, never think that what you are doing is too small, she tells Time for Kids. We need to think big as well as small. Learn to speak up and stand up for what we need. Safe Harbor is an animal rescue story, but it also explores topics like the immigrant experience, divorce, and dealing with change. Venkatraman also wants young readers to feel empowered to clean up the environment and ask for help doing it. All of us can do something, she says. The book Safe Harbor by Padma, P-A-D-M-A. Here's the last name, Venkatraman. V-E-N-K-A-T-R-A-M-A-N. And sticking with Time for Kids, looks like another book or review, I guess. Dawn to Dusk. That's by Time for Kid reporter Vivian Goldhirsch. Who is this? What is this here? TFK Kid reporter Vivian Goldhirsch read Almost Sunset and interviewed its author, Wahab Al-Garmi. Read Vivian's thoughts below. I will. I'll do it right now. Almost Sunset is a new graphic novel about a young boy named Hassan who is observing Ramadan. Every year, nearly 2 billion people celebrate Ramadan, a holy month for people who follow the Muslim faith. Ramadan is a month of fasting, which means observers don't eat or drink from dawn until sunset. Hassan hasn't told any of his peers about his fasting. He has to balance the different aspects of his life during Ramadan, such as playing sports, keeping up his grades, and spending time with friends and family. Wahab Al-Garmi, the author of Almost Sunset, told TFK that he wanted his parents' Yemeni roots to be part of the story. So he included a chapter in which Hassan travels to Yemen, a country in the Middle East. And he says, I really wanted to put the Yemeni culture in a book because this is for my community, he said. He explained that Hassan is loosely based on his son and himself and added that the writing came easily because he used his daily routine to write Hassan's routine. Al-Garmi was excited to share Ramadan's focus on reflection. For a month, you have to reset and reorganize your life around Ramadan. Calm down and relax, he told Time for Kids. I want to teach people that sometimes you need that spiritual reset, whether you are religious or not. Almost Sunset is a story of a young boy who is finding balance as he practices his family's traditions. It has funny moments and serious ones as well. I enjoyed learning about Ramadan and the character's love of the holiday. And let's do one more article from Time for Kids. Next Gen Jobs is the title of this by Lillian Stone. What jobs will we have in the future? A recent report explores that question. In January, the World Economic Forum, or WEF, released its 2025 Future of Jobs report. It included survey data from more than 1,000 of the world's largest employers, writes WEF Managing Director Sadia Zahidi. The landscape of work continues to evolve at a rapid pace. The report shows how work may change between now and 2030. It includes growth areas such as AI, FinTech, which is financial technology, and cybersecurity. It lists jobs that are on the decline, and it outlines skills that workers increasingly need. Some of the information from the report is shown here, and what surprises you? The fastest growing jobs. Number one, they have big data specialists. I'm not sure what big data, that's a dash, big data. Then there's FinTech engineers. What was that? Finance technology. AI and machine learning specialists is number four. Number four is software and applications developers. And number five is security management specialists. Those are the fastest growing jobs. The fastest declining jobs are postal service clerks, bank tellers, data entry clerks, cashier and ticket clerks, and administrative assistants and executive secretaries. Skills on the rise. First one they got here, AI and big data, and they have networks and cybersecurity. In third place, technology literacy. Fourth place, creative thinking. And five, resilience, flexibility, and agility. Okay, let's go over to Frontiers for Young Minds. Right here on Bigler's World. Okay, what is the name of this article? Why Some Kids May Need a New Liver. They got two authors here, Barbara E. Wildhaber and Valerie A. McLinn, wrote this particular article, which goes a little like this. The liver, your body's powerhouse. Did you know your liver is like a powerhouse inside your body, working every minute of the day to keep your body healthy? The liver performs hundreds of critical jobs like cleaning your blood, fighting off germs, and transforming the food you eat into energy for you to move and run and live your life. For example, the liver produces several important proteins. Proteins are like building blocks for your body, like Lego pieces. They come together to build and repair your muscles, skin, hair, and even help your body defend itself against viruses and bacteria. Proteins are super important for helping you to grow up strong and healthy. And if your blood needs to clot when you have a cut, your liver makes proteins to do that too. When your body needs to get rid of medications or toxins, the liver can help. It mixes the medicine or toxin with the juice coming out of the liver called bile. Bile flows through the bile ducts into the gut, which eventually deposits toxins in the toilet, if you get where they're going with that. Did you know that your liver is the heaviest organ in your body? The liver is located in the right upper section of your belly. A sheet of muscle called the diaphragm lies between the liver and the lungs, and the ribs protect both the lungs and the liver. If you weigh 40 kilograms, which I don't know how much that is, your liver is as healthy as a 1 liter milk bottle. The liver is unique in another way. It is the only organ whose blood supply comes from both an artery, the hepatic artery, and a vein, the portal vein. Where those two vessels go into the liver, there is another tube coming out of the liver called the bile duct, which carries bile to the intestine. When a liver needs a rescue. Sometimes a liver gets sick and can no longer do its job well. When the liver is damaged, doctors might decide it needs to be exchanged for a new one. This is called a liver transplant. I think you've heard of it. Think of it like changing a broken piece in a car. Liver transplantation is a special operation where the sick liver is completely removed and replaced with a healthy one that comes from a donor. The donor is a person who died of a severe brain injury that caused the brain to stop functioning, which is called brain death. When brain death is identified, the other organs are usually still working and can be donated for transplantation. If the person stated before their death that they wanted to donate their organs, then patients with a sick liver, heart, kidney, or lung can benefit from a new healthy organ. An organ donation is a very special gift that can save someone's life. The liver is unique in the world of organ transplantation because one donor can save two lives. When a small child needs a liver, they often only need a small part from an adult liver, the left lobe. The left lobe is the small left part of the liver, approximately a quarter of the whole organ. The right lobe can then be given to an adult. The procedure of surgically separating the liver into two halves is called a liver split. Don't be confused with a banana split. Who might need a new liver? Well, the most frequent reason why a child would need a new liver is because they were born with a disease called biliary atresia. In this, the bile ducts are progressively damaged, leading to complete blockage of bile flow. When the bile stays in the liver instead of flowing out, it gradually damages the liver, eventually resulting in cirrhosis or severe liver disease. Another reason why children may need a new liver is because they are born with an inborn error of metabolism. These are diseases in which a protein works incorrectly. In other words, a certain Lego piece is the wrong shape to do its job. For example, purifying toxins, which can make children very sick. Even if the liver looks normal in these children, a liver transplant may be the only way to cure the disease. How do you know if someone's liver is in trouble? Well, you can look out for signs like jaundice, which shows up as yellow skin or eyes, together with feeling really tired and not hungry or having a bloated belly. These clues tell doctors that the liver might be sick. Doctors then draw blood samples and do other exams to understand, treat, and follow the liver disease. The heroic journey of a liver transplant. Before performing a liver transplant, doctors do a lot of tests to make sure that this major surgery is the right solution for the child. This important step helps ensure that the child is well taken care of, both before and after surgery. Then doctors put the child on a waiting list. This means the child waits their turn for a good liver match. Surgery to take the old liver out and put the new liver in is long and complicated, but doctors and nurses make sure everything goes smoothly. The operation usually takes approximately 6 to 8 hours. The sick liver is completely removed and replaced with the new one. As you know now, often just with the small left lobe of an adult liver. During the operation, the child's liver veins and arteries and bile duct are connected to those of the new liver using stitches, much like a tailor or a seamstress would use. This is quite tricky since the vessels are very small, sometimes only 2 millimeters in diameter. Following the operation, the young patient stays in intensive care for several days. Intensive care is a special place in the hospital where doctors and nurses take care of people minute by minute, as is required after a transplant. Once the child is better, they move to the normal ward for up to 2 weeks before returning home. When they finally return home, they feel like a regular kid again in a short period of time. Throughout this journey, patients stay with their children to support them every step of the way. Life with a new liver. After receiving a new liver, life is a little different. During the first months of after transplantation, the young patient will need to take many medications, mostly to help their body and liver to get to know each other. Meanwhile, the liver recovers from its epic adventure by adjusting its size and shape to meet the needs of the child's body. As the child or young person grows, so does the transplanted liver, just like anyone's liver would. Regular visits to the doctor are required to check on the patient's progress. After some months with their new liver, kids can go back to doing all the things they love and may only have to take 1 to 2 pills daily. They can go back to daycare or school, perform all their favorite sports or after-school activities, and see their friends. Eventually, they grow up to be adults who can get married and have their own kids if they want to. Okay, I have a few minutes here. Let's go to newsforkids.net. This article, Doctors Say Vaccines Key to Fighting U.S. Measles Outbreak. This was put together by the News for Kids editors. The U.S. is facing a serious measles outbreak. When did this come out? This article came out today, March 18th, with over 300 cases reported across 14 states so far this year. That's more cases in the first 3 months of 2025 than in all of last year. The rise in measles cases is connected to a drop in vaccination rates. As right here, measles is an unpleasant disease. They got a picture of a kid here just to show you what it looked like that has killed millions of people. Measles spreads very easily. If someone with measles coughs or sneezes, their germs can stay in the air for hours. That means it's super easy to get measles if you're not protected. The illness brings a high fever and an itchy rash that covers most of the body. Though most children survive the measles, it is deadly in roughly one or two cases out of every 1,000. But even those who survive can have other problems, like having difficulty fighting off other diseases. For years, doctors and scientists have known how to control measles. There's a vaccine to stop it. With one shot, a person is 93% protected. Two shots are recommended because that offers 97% protection against the measles. The U.S. began using the measles vaccine in 1963. Before that, there were hundreds of thousands of cases of measles each year. By the 1980s, there were only thousands, and by the early 2000s, there were usually fewer than 100 cases a year, and the U.S. considered measles eliminated. But in recent years, the number of measles cases has been rising. The measles situation in the U.S. is much less severe than in many other parts of the world. The threat is still an important one, and it doesn't have to happen at all. Sadly, many people aren't protected against measles because they aren't getting vaccinated. Only 2% of the people who got measles this year were fully vaccinated. Vaccinations don't only protect people who are vaccinated. If enough people are vaccinated, it prevents the disease from spreading, which protects even those who aren't vaccinated. Scientists say that about 95% of the population needs to be vaccinated to help protect everyone, but currently only 11 U.S. states have vaccination rates at or above 95%. In Texas, there have been over 250 cases of measles this year, and one child has died. Most of the cases are in areas where vaccination rates are low. In some parts of the world, people don't get vaccinated because there aren't enough vaccines, but that's not true in the U.S. And with that, I am out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.